Hello, everyone. This is The Stark Truth on Countercurrents Radio. I'm your host, Robert Stark. My guest is James O'Mara. So, James, it's nice having you on the show. And your book, The Homo and the Negro, is just out.
Yes, indeed. It is available for purchase in both hardcover and paperback.
And what gave you the idea originally to write this book?
Actually, the idea to write the book was Greg Johnson of Countercurrents fame. I had been writing some things on my blog, and I had offered some of them to him when he was looking for material for Countercurrents, and he liked them, started publishing them. I continued to write things for Countercurrent, and at one point he said, "Now, what are we going to put into this book of yours?" or words to that effect, or "I think we have enough here now for a book," or something, words like that. So this was entirely his idea. You know, would not have occurred to me in my native modesty. We went back and forth a little bit. I went back to things from my blog that had never been republished, and rewrote and polished them, and combined some things together, and so on. And we went back and forth, and eventually created a list of things we wanted to include. And during this process, a few more things were written, such as a long piece on the movie The Untouchables. And Greg decided it would actually be best to split up what we had. So this is actually the first in a series of books, a veritable decline and fall of the Roman Empire, or Twilight of the West, or something of that sort. For people who are familiar with what I've been publishing on the blog, Countercurrents, what's going into the second book will be some of those pieces on Lovecraft and Julius Evola. Lovecraft, Evola, and Henry James. There's a whole sequence of pieces, which was my original idea for the book, was to be just a short little book containing those pieces, because they seem to be the most bookish. But the book, as it's turned out, this first one that's being published is more political and sort of pop cultural. It's a lot of stuff about movies and pop music and even clothing styles and haircuts, but all written from that somewhat unusual vantage point I call my own, which Jack Donovan in a blurb he contributed to the book cover, which I like, calls a psychedelic perspective, which I think hits the nature of my approach to these issues, which is, I think, unique, certainly on the right, even the so-called alternative right. It's something we might almost call a psychedelic right, or I was thinking a few days ago of a phrase that popped into my head of gonzo traditionalism. If you could imagine someone with Hunter Thompson's writing style and interests, but with the principles of Baron Evola, then you might have some idea what the content looks like if you haven't been following it on Countercurrents.
Do you identify yourself as a traditionalist?
For want of anything else, I would have to. You might say the pieces in the book are various attempts to reconcile, I guess, interests in pop culture and what might be called alternative lifestyles, the hidden history of the Western world, to reconcile those interests with, you know, an acknowledgement of the truth and profundity of the sort of principles enunciated in the writings of Evola and Guinan, and perhaps most of all Kumaraswamy. I think it's not too grand a statement, just to give people an idea of how the book is written. It occurred to me that a few days ago that it's kind of like the way Kumaraswamy wrote his pieces, which, you know, if you look at the way they're printed, they tend to have like three or four lines at the top of the page, and then the rest of the page is a bunch of footnotes. Which in my own case, as I discuss in the book, there's an interview with me by Greg Johnson that's reprinted at the end of the book, and in which I discuss how coming to the internet and to the blogging world kind of liberated my writing style and you know, sort of unleashed this flood of essays, because it enabled me to sort of just like start writing and keep writing. I suppose it's like when, you know, Jack Kerouac taped together all that paper into a one big roll, or when Henry James discovered the typewriter. Not that he typed anything, but he hired a nice nice series of women studies works and explains Kerouac's style, and I think explains my own style. It's a sort of a traditionalism in the internet age where you don't have to worry as much about typewriters and paper and stuff like that. There's a more of a stream of consciousness flow to it, which I think is what Jack Donovan is getting at with the idea of it being psychedelic.
So let's get to the sort of the title, The Homo and the Negro. It is a very kind of provocative title.
It's a provocative title. When I said earlier that we had put together these pieces that appeared on Countercurrents, there's actually a couple pieces that did not appear that were actually earlier than my meeting with Greg. And as I talk in the interview when Greg is asking me about the origin of various ideas, I had, again, through the internet, had met up with the writings of an English figure on the New Right by the name of Alistair Clarke, to whom the book is dedicated, actually. He unfortunately died 2 or 3 years ago. And actually, I guess maybe the book is in some way kind of a memorial, or if that's too grand a word, or just sort of like acknowledging his work. And I, at a certain point, I decided, well, if he could do that, I could do that. He had a blog where he ranted about things. And so that's really what started me doing the blog. And the point is that I, at some point, decided that I would create what I humorously called a manifesto, because his ideas and my ideas were as we've been saying, of the right, but not like anything else on the right. So I thought, well, why don't we do up a manifesto, like, you know, Hakim Bey's Temporary Autonomous Zone or something like that. And so I created this manifesto, which is the first chapter in the book, and it's where the book gets its title from, because I thought it needed, the manifesto when it was originally done needed a provocative title, and The Homo and the Negro was the obvious title. And that was published actually in an online journal of Kai Mura, who I assume you're familiar with. Unfortunately, I can't think of it now, but I believe he's Finnish, if I'm not mistaken. So he published that 2 or 3 years ago in his online journal, which has the title The Journal. That journal was an attempt to do something like what I do in this book, namely to bring a sort of new rightist perspective onto some, you know, neglected or ignored or even denounced kind of areas, like in his case, fashion. So the manifesto was sort of geared towards the idea of looking at almost fashion, really, sort of like, why do people dress in the awful way they do today? And it sort of like evolved out of that into a general notion that the problem with the right is that its acceptance of Judeo-Christianity is sort of ties it to a sort of homophobic perspective, which has the consequence of eliminating from the movement many, if not all, of its most creative voices. Conversely, and perversely, and ironically, causing them to consciously or not idealize what they might otherwise think of as their polar opposite, namely black culture, which is, you know, paradoxically seen as, it's a safe ground to run to, because if you're not black, you must be gay.
Oh, so you're saying that the sort of the premise is that the homo and the negro are polar opposites. That's an very interesting point to interesting thing to point out, because like your average kind of right winger might think that the popular culture of Hollywood is both homo and negro at the same time. So you believe that's a major misconception?
Yes, I would say that there's a subtlety to it, because and this is a particularly valuable point I owe to Alistair, is that and one reason why I'm using the word homo, which again is an attempt to be provocative, but I didn't want to use the word gay and or queer, I guess, which is what seems to be an acceptable term in academic world, where there's actual professors and departments of queer theory now. What as Alistair says, and I quote him extensively on this topic, that there's post Stonewall, there's a myth, there's a fake gay identity which is created by the left, in which they you see the way this works. You see is that the Judeo-Christian influences drives homosexuals out of society and into the arms of the left. And so they're they're drafted into the great Rainbow Liberation Coalition of people whose job it is, first and foremost, to destroy society. And what they're offered by the left is, well, you know, these people all hate you anyway, and if you help us tear down society, we'll reward you in the future utopia. So what Alistair and I have been talking about, and what goes back to the roots of Western and Aryan civilization, is what might be called homoeroticism, which is not necessarily homosexual, but is involved in you know, the idealization of the male and male concepts and male ideas. And this is distinct from the sort of Judeo-Christian concept of family values, also distinct from the left concept of the promiscuous, drug-addled, post-sexual liberation kind of gay identity.
And with the gay identity, I noticed there's if you sort of look at the post-Stonewall gay identity, there's sort of in the 70s and the 80s, the sort of you're talking about the promiscuous kind of stereotype. And then the thing, the trend now is about gays sort of becoming like straight people, like heterosexuals, and getting married and adopting kids. I mean, what do you think about all that?
Well, that's exactly what I'm talking about, because, you know, if you think about it, when somebody tells you that claims that Alexander the Great was gay or something like that, or Leonardo da Vinci, leaving aside the truth or not of that, the thing that automatically comes to mind is some sort of Monty Python character that talks with a lispy English accent and wears a pink toga, you know. That's not what they were. That whole element of Western culture, which goes back, Evelot in Men Among the Ruins talks about Aryan culture arising in the Manerbund, the warrior bands of youths that separate themselves from the family. They create the state and culture. The family creates, well, society, the welfare state, and so on. What happens here is that you now have three negative negative images going on here. You have the right, which, because of its Judeo-Christian notions, projects this image of the homosexual as the demonic, you know, possessed by demons, evil, hell-bound creature, which is obviously a bad thing to be. You don't want to be that. And also, of course, they make it illegal and punish you, so it's a bad thing. And on the left, as part of what I was just saying about constructing this post-Stonewall identity, the first move was to create this image of the homosexual. See, and the point is, I remember this because I grew up during that period. I was very young, but I mean, I grew up during that period. I remember what was written about in the Village Voice and New York Magazine and whatnot. And the image that was presented was that homosexuals were better than straight people because they could have lots of sex and didn't have to get married.
Yeah, that's what the word gay originally meant. Originally, the word gay was used to just sort of describe straight bachelors who like had a lot of sex, but then the word gay sort of became in vogue instead of homosexual.
Right. And, you know, without going trying to make any claims about the accuracy of this, I sort of like, you know, adopt this kind of nomenclature for my purposes here. So the gay identity was initially that. And, of course, AIDS came. And, of course, you know, this was the period when the slogan was smash monogamy. And homosexuals were not just liberated and equal. They were better than straight people because they were doing what all men want to do, which is have anonymous sex all the time. And, you know, those pitiable breeders were the ones that were, you know, suckered into marriage. Well, AIDS came along, of course, and kind of put the kibosh on that. So you couldn't present that as a reasonable ideal anymore. And eventually what they came up with was gay marriage. And suddenly we're supposed to believe that homosexuals all this time that they've been relentlessly persecuted by society have always wanted one thing, which is to marry the love of their life and raise children. Justin Raimondo, the libertarian who runs the antiwar.com website, has written over the years a number of excellent pieces on the ridiculousness of the notion of gay marriage. And it's very interesting that they've actually, you know, the left always does things with words because they live in a dream world where words are reality. So they think that if you use a word, you're attacking someone, which is why they have speech codes and things. And they also think that you can solve problems by changing the words. You know, hence, you know, they're not Negroes, they're black. They're not black, they're African-American, and so on. So they've decided that that they're going to change the phrase from same-sex marriage or gay marriage. They're going to get rid of that phrase. And now the new phrase is marriage equality, because now they fully assimilated it to their civil rights model. So now the idea is that if you're against marriage equality, you're against equality, which, of course, is the greatest sin on the left. So that really reveals the leftist plot behind this notion. It's not just, oh, why don't you just let people get married? You know, as far as I'm concerned, that's fine. If people want to get married, they want to call it a doing marriage, I don't care. The ideological component, though, is the pushing the notion that all homosexuals want to get married, and also the notion that if you oppose that or you think it's ridiculous, then you're some sort of fascist, in, you know, in their negative sense of fascist. The point of what I'm talking about here is that, unlike the days of Alexander the Great or Leonardo da Vinci, these are the three alternatives that you're presented with, and they're not good. In all of these alternatives, homosexuals are basically offered various ways of life, none of which have anything to do with creating culture and creating the state. You know, they're either in a bathhouse or they're married and raising children just like everyone else, and that's marriage equality. They're just like us. They're not supposed to be. I mean, on the right, the idea is they shouldn't exist, right? So you kill them, or you transform them, or if you can't do anything with them, you put them in prison, or they stay in the closet, as the saying goes. So on the right, they're not supposed to exist. On the left, they're supposed to either be in the bathhouse or raising children in the suburbs just like everyone else. So I hope I've made that clear, that you see all these alternatives here all involve erasing the homosexual. So, or the homoerotic. And the point about the manifesto of the homo and the negro is that the fear of the homosexual bleeds off into a fear of the homoerotic, so that you prove your non-homosexuality by being as crude and dirty and stupid as possible, which is where the negro comes in. And so the negro becomes the model. You know, no matter whether the right people on the right think that they're pro-white or people on the left think people on the right are racist, the irony is that everyone takes the Negro as the ideal. There's a lot of things you can say against William F. Buckley, but it's interesting that at one time he was a leader of the right. He was the face of the right, if you will, and it's impossible to imagine that now because he would just be dismissed as a fag. And this is my point, of course. You know, I mean, he wasn't gay. He wasn't homosexual, as far as we know.
So his ideas were bad, but because of his image, he sort of had this image as being kind of a semi-effeminate sort of intellectual type, as opposed to the image that conservatives take on today.
Leaving aside whether or not we agree with his ideas, and I don't, I mean, he's very bad for the right, but he couldn't even have risen to prominence today because he would have been simply dismissed right at the start. And what he was articulating, it's interesting that the image he presented was really quite attractive and popular in the 50s and 60s because people recognized it as being an upper-class aristocrat of exactly the sort who would be produced by and would run a conservative society. You know, as the expression goes, you know, he's not gay, he's just English. You contrast Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity with someone like William F. Buckley. As you know, as I say in the manifesto, I mean the high point of the American right was when its leading figures were William F. Buckley, J. Edgar Hoover, Whitaker Chambers, Roy Cohn, and Francis Cardinal Stone, all of whom are either homosexual or perceived as effeminate. None of these people would have had a chance in the right today. To give a more concrete example, though, and the one I talk about in the book in my chapter on fashion tips, the writer Alex Krtajic, I'm not sure how to pronounce his name, who writes frequently on alternativeright.com, which makes him a good guy. But as an example of the sort of trap that one falls into, he had a piece which I critique in the essay in as a starting point for this thing on fashion, where he's eulogizing, you know, he goes to an exhibit of photographs of coal miners from Britain in the 19th century, and he proceeds to eulogize these guys, who he actually calls troglodytes. He talks about their troglodytic appearance, you know, because after years of working in the mines, you know, they're all bent over and cramped up and so on, and they're covered, they're black, essentially, they're covered in in coal dust. You know, they're coughing out their lungs. You can't really see that in the photos, but you know that. You know that these guys are all dying of horrible diseases and so on. They've been ruthlessly exploited their whole life, and he thinks of them as an ideal, which we should approximate more to. That the right would be better off if we were tough guys like these guys.
So the thing about the right today is they're hostile to this anyone who's sort of either creative or an intellectual.
Essentially, yeah. I mean, that's sort of like putting it at its most extreme point. I mean, that's the point it would reach more on the playgrounds of America where the new generation is being raised. It's interesting that anyone who does well in school or seems to like education or dresses neatly, there's only two words for him. If he's white, he's a fag, and if he's black, he's acting white. And that's it in a nutshell. Now, of course, there's nothing that blunt on the right. And, of course, obviously, there's lots of intelligent people on the right who don't go around saying, you know, I hate schools, you know, or anything like that. We've had enough of this book learning or anything like that. But the point I make in that manifesto is that the panic about being taken for homosexual is so great that it bleeds over into anything that homosexuals seem to excel at. And that generally means something like what you're referred to as creativity. And the obvious effect of that is that that's not going to be available to the right for strategy, for creating symbols, which is really what it's all about. You're not going to be able to even really organize in any way. I mean, if you think of all the effective right-wing organizations from Sparta to the SA in Germany, they're all perceived by even by the left when they want to attack these right-wing groups and so on. They're all perceived as a bunch of fags.
So there's sort of a perception among people on the right that the left and the mainstream culture wants to sort of stigmatize homophobia. And you totally disagree with that argument.
Well, I wouldn't deny that mainstream culture wants to stigmatize homophobia. What I think I would say is that the sort of what really I think upset people on the right and perhaps legitimately so is the kind of homosexuality that's being promoted, and that gets back to what I was saying of the two models on the left. And what's completely covered over in this is the fact that if you actually look at the history of Western culture, it's been largely created by people who would be considered to be either homosexual or homoerotic, but were thought of by their societies and thought of themselves as being an essential and natural part of their society. You know, this is all dismissed by the left as they were all living in the closet, because they couldn't really freely express themselves. And by freely express themselves, they mean something like have a gay pride parade and throw condoms at St. Patrick's Cathedral. An essay that's going to be in the next book it appears on Countercurrents a couple weeks ago on Ralph Adams Cram, probably America's greatest architect, certainly the greatest Gothic architect. He designed the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, for instance, and also most of the collegiate Gothic architecture in America. There's a nice biography of him by Douglas Shantucci that's a little too leftist in its orientation, but nevertheless makes the point that here is someone who conceived of himself as a traditionalist, even uses that word, a traditionalist, was an Anglo-Catholic convert, lived in Boston, quite respectable, designed cathedrals, a great architect. He seems to have been sort of bisexual, more or less. And he had a wife and children, perfectly respectable, and he had a little monastery in Wales where other Anglo-Catholics of his bent would have little meetings and gatherings, sort of like Bohemian Grove. And this is the kind of thing that Evelyn Waugh has a character saying, stay away from Anglo-Catholics, they're all sodomites with atrocious accents. That's actually a reference to the Cram Circle. My point being that here's a guy who sees himself as a part of the highest reaches of American culture and society and was seen as such. He had to keep a lot of stuff under wraps, but he didn't see himself as being oppressed by his society and that society needed to be changed and or dismantled, which is what's being promoted on the left. So what the right is seeing correctly, I think, is that what's being promoted by the left, what's being forced on people by the left, is this idea that Adams Cram should have liberated himself by going to San Francisco and riding in a gay pride float and throwing condoms at a cathedral. He thought what he should be doing was building cathedrals.
So that gets to what Jack Donovan, in his review of your book, he said how the problem is that today the right is, what he says is that suffocating from a bourgeois blandness, incapable of igniting the imagination, and has this sort of a creepy puritanical, obsession of excelling the homo has driven a disproportionate number of men whose natural talents would make them best able to translate virality into transcendent high culture. So the key, what I'm getting at is your key thing is that the role of the homosexuals is as creators of culture.
Yeah. Yeah, in a word. And, you know, if the right prevents that by harassing and erasing them, and the left perverts it by you know, either dissuading them from culture because, you know, you can't create culture when you're in a bathhouse all night, or perverting it into, instead of creating white Aryan culture and Western civilization, it's just tearing that down, putting your talents towards tearing that down, and presumably creating some utopian leftist culture of the future, which is, you know, probably just a bunch of nonsense anyway. More likely something more like the Soviet Union, you know, destroy the evil Russian aristocrats and create this gulag nightmare. But as you can see, I mean, these are the three things. Hide in the closet, don't do anything that might even resemble something a fag would do, like design cathedrals. One point I make is all the intellectuals on the right, to say nothing of traditionalists, are all in contemporary culture considered to be fags. I mean, you know, I mean, they, even to the extent, you know, I talked about Buckley no longer being acceptable, but even to the extent today, you know, people on the right who you know, put together coherent sentences and read a bunch of books, I mean, what's gayer than that? They're in an untenable position because they're committed by their religion to hating faggots, but at the same time, they can't be intellectuals of any sort without coming across as being gay. They said before, you know, the remark about, you know, people not being gay, they're English. Basically, you know, just that perception that anything resembling culture, polish, success, how much of stuff on the right is devoted to lauding mediocrity and how wonderful those trailer park redneck types are and how real and authentic, and that's the real America, and you know, spending your time, you know, building museums where cavemen ride on dinosaurs and so on. I mean, this is perceived as being, you know, this is the culture we want to preserve against those fancy pants intellectuals. You know, you're never going to get anywhere like that. The movement isn't going to work because it's going to be run by idiots, and you don't even want it to work because it's basically designed to be tearing down Western civilization, which is a subtlety here, which I might go back to, is that I keep talking about Judeo-Christianity. You know, I mean, Western civilization is created by pagan, and at a certain point, there's an intersection with Judaism. The culture that goes forward from that is Barnevelis said in the phrase, you know, the Roman Church. Roman refers to Rome, and the Church refers to Christianity. So, you know, when people talk about the achievements of the Middle Ages and so on, and certainly Cram was a great enthusiast for them, you know, the achievements are the remains of the Romans and the Greeks. And the bad side of things, like the aversion to bathing, for instance, comes from the Christians. So there's always been this kind of warfare but since the Roman fall of the Roman Empire, there's been this kind of warfare between the authentic white Aryan elements, which for convenience we'll call classicism, and the Christian elements, which are a kind of crypto-Judaism. And that's where all the family value stuff comes from, and the homophobia. So if you're talking about preserving Western civilization, or you're talking about Western civilization is great and we should defend it, what are you defending? Most of what's on the right seems to have taken the Judaic branch. Point is that is actually at war with Aryan civilization. That's the negative component. And, you know, Baron Evola said that all nations are composed of various racial strains, and the job of the racial eugenicist is to select the one that is the dominate. And select the Jewish one, you're going to wind up with a Mormon president, you know, with family values and big families and all that, and you're going to get a country as uninteresting and uncultured and unsophisticated and thuggish as Israel. You know, if you want to look at what the world without white people would be, look at Israel, because there you have the quintessence of the Jewish state, as it calls itself, and that's what we need to be fighting against. Of course, everything on the right, especially since it's been taken over by neocons, everything on the right leads towards idealizing Israel and essentially trying to make America into Israel, whether it's the war on terror or everything else. And again, that's a function of the same argument that I've been making, the homo and the Negro. You know, there's a quotation from the MC5 that I have at the beginning of the book, "You must choose, brothers, you must choose." And that's essentially what the argument of the book is.
On the question of traditionalism, you say really existing tradition. So you're talking about the role of homosexuals in traditional societies.
Yeah, that piece is an academic sort of piece. But it's actually sort of ripped from the headlines, if I may say so, because let me get into it by alluding to something everyone's talking about, or at least on the Fox News channel, the events in Benghazi. And you remember that the Obama administration's initial explanation was that these people were upset by a terrible movie that said terrible things about the Prophet Muhammad. Okay? Now, if you look at what the terrible things the movie says about the Prophet Muhammad, perhaps the most incendiary things are, and I get this from Justin Raimondo, who wrote a column about this, are the claim that Muhammad was a homosexual. Now, this is exactly what I'm talking about, because there's an excellent book by John R. Bradley called Behind the Veil of Vice, in which he talks about what the actual societies in the Arab world. And to go back to what I was just saying about Rome and Christianity, Islam is sort of a version of Judaism and Christianity that is Semitic enough, but did not reject Greek, which is why in Islamic culture they continued science and literature and so on. All that stuff was thrown away by the Christians and re-entered Europe through the Arabs. And they didn't tear down the public baths because they like to bathe. Christians hate bathing.
I guess to a lot of social conservatives today, the idea of public bathing probably sounds pretty homoerotic to them.
Exactly. And, of course, back in the day, you know, the Jews hated it as well, mainly because it revealed their mark. And so there's all kinds of, and of course the public baths in classical civilization were the meeting places. They were the internet of the day.
But that's true with, I think, Europe. If you compare Europe and America, I mean, it is stuff like public bathing among men is more popular in Europe. Well, in America, like the idea of a bunch of men being naked in a bath or in a sauna would be totally homosexual in this country.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, this country can't even tolerate the movie 300, you know, without thinking they're just a bunch of fags. But here's my thing, that so the actual, you know, there's very little in the Quran that talks. There's nothing, in other words, that like you would find in the Old Testament condemning homosexuality.
Oh, so you're saying that modern day Muslims are. Many of them are anti-gay because of what the Old Testament says, not because of the Quran.
Well, not so much that as a slightly different version of that, which is what I'm getting at, that until the influence of the West came, in other words, they had a perfectly natural notion of human sexuality, which was that women were secluded away and boys would get up to what you might expect adolescent boys to get up to if they have no access to women. And at a certain age, you are expected as part of society to get married and have children, and they all do. And it's expected that some of those men will continue to have these childish tastes, and it's thought of as being a sort of a mild flaw and a matter for a little giggling and so on, but not a big deal. And you can still find that in Arab street society, as they used to say, the Arab street. But the first thing that happened was the westernization through colonialism, which brought in Victorian, i.e. Christian, i.e. Jewish, attitude. And then, on top of that, you got the more modern Westerners coming in with their notions of gay liberation and so on. So you have at work the same factors we had here in Western culture, namely the homophobic Christian element and then the leftist liberational element. You know, so in other words, homosexuality became stigmatized as an example of Western decadence. And so now the governments now, are sort of like, you have the fundamentalists who are condemning homosexuality both as itself and as an element of Westernism and so on, completely untraditional in Islamic culture, but influenced by probably the Old Testament or something, which is why we call them fundamentalists. I mean, they have a more of a Protestant even idea of Islam than any Islamic person ever had in the past. So they've been decisively influenced by the West in that way, and then the governments try to chime in on this and be more fundamentalist than the fundamentalists and be seen as some idiot Westerners will come in and try to have a gay pride march, and then this will be condemned by the fundamentalists, and then the government will suppress it to show the people they're on the side of the religion. And all this is completely manufactured because of the idiot Western influence, either, again, getting back to my example, this shouldn't be a matter of gay pride parades where they're throwing condoms at either a cathedral or a mosque, or for that matter, the gay pride parade that Putin suppressed in Moscow. Alistair wrote a piece at that time saying, hooray for Putin, because he's keeping, the Russian nation free of these terrible leftist Western influences. It's not about homosexuality. It's about this anti-civilizational leftist gay identity that's being celebrated by the people in the hot pants on the trucks in the gay pride parade. That has nothing to do with this element in Western civilization. It's a leftist creation, and it's rightly suppressed. And my point being here that you see how this functions in that movie. If you think of these people in the West, these neocons, say, what's the worst thing we could say about Muhammad? Oh, he's gay. And then they make the movie, and then, of course, the Islamists explode in rage. And you wouldn't think that if you actually knew something about Muslim history, that there were all kinds of these elements in Islam, as long as they were kept in where they belonged and weren't flaunted. And so on. The idea, for instance, that there's a whole tradition of contemplation of the beautiful boy in Islamic poetry. The greatest of Islamic poets are in this strain. It's completely impossible to imagine this being done either today in Islam or for that matter in Christianity. I mean, can you imagine some Mormon poet belonging to the school that contemplates the beauty of the boy? Pointing out, of course, that in a line with the Quran, there's no physical contact. So that makes it Quranic, you see. But, of course, in Christianity, that would be totally beyond the bend. Why? Because of this kind of one-drop rule, as they used to say about having black ancestors. That's the point I'm making. The one-drop rule, where any hint that it might be sort of like homosexuality or homoeroticism will get something completely banned, either by law or more importantly, in our cultural understanding, right? You can't do that because it sounds like you're gay. Whereas, in Islam, you could say, well, I don't have sex with boys, but I contemplate their beautiful form and to the glory of Allah. Oh, that's acceptable, you see? That's not gay liberation, but on the other hand, it's not the conservative model.
If you think about all the statues from the Roman and the Greek era, or even later on in the Renaissance era, like the Statue of David, that would be, an artist doing that today would be automatically accused of being a homosexual.
Oh, of course. Of course. And would probably be burned or imprisoned or punished in some way at other periods of Western society.
Victorians, like they tried to censor a lot of that artwork.
In the biography of Cram, this is on my mind because I wrote the piece about him recently, and I'm also finally getting a copy of the biography to read. there was a whole controversy in Boston in the 1890s about when they built the Museum of Fine Arts. And there were various statues that were not part of the collection, but were part of the decoration. You know, they create, you know, public art, you know, around the country, that were tremendously unpopular and were actually banned. And they were only recently, like in the 1970s, finally brought out of mothballs. So that kind of thing goes on, was going on even in Cran's time, and that he was a part of. There was a statue of a Bacchante, one of the intoxicated followers of Bacchus, and that was really offended the Bostonians. I don't think because she was naked, but because she was drunk and she had a little boy with her. And so they were really upset about that. But anyway, my point is that real traditionalism, as it really exists in real historically existing traditional societies, such as Islam, is much healthier than the sort of thing we have today, where it's either the Victorianism or the bathhouse.
Well, about the idea about sexuality is what stance or attitudes should society take towards sexuality as a whole? Because in our country, a lot of the people on the right have a very puritanical view, and they get those people are kind of viewed as prudes. Then we have the whole sort of the mentality about sex that came out of the sexual revolution. What would you like to see as an attitude towards sexuality as a whole?
Well, actually, you know, as an outline, what I was just saying about what Bradley describes as the attitude of traditional Muslim society, even today, you know, beneath the levels of these literate people who are Western educated and, you know, either want to bring back Sharia law or completely Westernized. Those are all Western educated people. They have nothing to do. Alain Danielou, I have to mention this, is the traditionalist that I get much of this from, and who was a perfectly open homosexual. That didn't prevent Evola and Ginon and Kumaraswamy from accepting him among their number. In fact, he's one of the four leading traditionalists. And he lived in India. He went to India in the 30s. In a traditional Indian society, you know, the primitive people, they had no problem with his being homosexual, and he was initiated into various Hindu cults. He received a complete Hindu education, you know, as far as a Western European could, and that was the key, of course, because being a European, he was an outcast, and therefore was not eligible for marriage, and therefore they didn't care what he did. And as I was saying about Islamic society, it was the same thing, you know, or in Greece for that matter. Your social duty was to marry and raise children. As long as you did that, everything else was, you know, more or less a matter of taste. Which is not to say that these were, you know, completely non-homophobic societies. I mean, all societies tend to be, because there tends to be a need to enforce, you know, heterosexuality, because, you know, otherwise who would do it?
In the past, the focus of traditionalists was on the chastity of women. But a lot of them, like the homosexual issue, was kind of a side issue. With modern day conservatives, it's the other way around. They care more about they're obsessed with homosexuality, but they won't say anything critical about female sexuality.
Yeah, that's an interesting way to put it. Let me just say here. One thing that's in the book, there are a number of essays where I do take a look at more contemporary figures and how that, contrary to the leftist idea that they were living in the closet and tormented and wanted to destroy society if only they could have a chance to avenge themselves. I have an essay on Noel Coward, for instance, which at various points discusses his rather interesting ideas on what he owes to society and what the artist's responsibility is, and contrasts himself towards the end with this modern, you know, gay liberation nonsense. You know, here's somebody who's fairly open about being a homosexual at a time when it was an offense that could put you in prison, and nobody seemed to have any problem with it. You know, maybe this is a model for people. I take a look at the television series Mad Men as from a fashion point of view, really, and suggesting that this is a model for the right to adopt. And, you know, discussing along the way, you know, why the right doesn't seem to want to have people wear snappy clothes and great hats and suits and so on.
Yeah, I mean, I would say, I'd even say the same thing about National Socialism. If you look at the National Socialist the aesthetics and how people the uniforms and there were high aesthetic standards, but among like a lot of the so-called neo-Nazis of today, the way they're dressed is kind of very trashy.
Well, you see, that's part of the we're on the right, we're real men, we're hard men. That's the phrase Kurtajic uses, hard men. We're hard men, and so of course we dress like slobs, you know.
So Kurtajic, he defends that.
Well, not that so much, but I mean he's talking about his Welsh miners and how they should be a model for us. And I ask the question, well, exactly how are they supposed to be a model? You know, let yourself be oppressed by the Victorian overlords, be squashed down into a troglodytic posture, and so on. And you know, it goes off from there and starts talking about. At the same period of time, Oscar Wilde was touring the United States, and the real American miners, not the British miners that Kurtajic talks about, but the actual American coal miners and cowboys and so on, thought Oscar Wilde was a great guy. And they liked his clothing. They liked I forget the word for it now, but you know, with like the silk stockings and the short pants and all that, and they said it was a very practical garb.
If he went to some like a redneck bar in, say, West Virginia, the coal miners today would probably have a very different reaction.
They probably would, and that's a very interesting thing. I'm not sure exactly why that would be, and I would hypothesize it's because of the ever continuing progress of this mentality. But if you look at the news accounts from the 19th century of Oscar Wilde's tour, I discuss this in the book. He was loved by these guys. He went to San Francisco. He drank a bunch of gamblers under the table, beat them at cards. They all proclaimed him a bully boy, and all this. I mean, you know, there was absolutely no concept that this was someone who was effeminate, was weak, and so on. You know, and an article I look at in that essay on this topic says that among other things, long flowing hair was in the Wild West was the symbol of man's freedom, and this is essentially the thing I keep getting at over and over again, from the ancient manor bund to the Wild West, the real Wild boys, to use William Burroughs' term, were people who were not living a life of family values. They went west, the cowboys, to get away from families, and they expressed themselves by, among other things, wearing their hair long. So, you know, the actual cowboys and hard men of the American West, the freest Americans that ever lived, you know, looked more like the audience at an MC5 concert in Detroit in 1972. Rather than, you know, either a redneck bar today or a meeting of the American Conservative League or whatever. So these may seem like trivial things, but if they seem trivial, it may be because you've been brainwashed by this mentality. And as you were saying correctly, you know, in the National Socialist movement, they understood this. They understood that they needed people who could create symbols and make films and music and so on. I haven't done enough research to prove this, but it's completely in conformity to my thesis in the book that National Socialism went downhill once they got rid of the SA, the great purge of the homo. It was downhill from there. These were the people who put them in power, and then they were sacrificed, thrown under the bus, as we would say. And everything went to hell from then on. You know, as an example of my general thesis, there's a wonderful book you can get free online called The Pink Swastika by these conservative Christians who condemned the Nazis, not so much because they were Nazis, but because they were all homos, at least according to these guys. I mean, they're kind of crazy, so it's not really reliable history, but the mentality is interesting.
They accuse Hitler of being gay, like that's the worst thing he could be.
Oh, it's actually better than that. It's not so much he was gay. I don't think they go that far, although they're fond of throwing suspicions around. Hitler says something, they claim. Again, the history is wonky, but I'm just talking about the mentality they express. They claim that Hitler said at one point, "I don't care what anyone does in the bedroom as long as they are a good party member." Right? And you would think that any normal person today would say, "Why, it looks like Hitler was the first Bill Clinton with his don't ask, don't tell policy." Right? Today, that would be seen as enlightened opinion on Hitler's part, but they give it as evidence of how evil he is. So everyone is either homosexual or too tolerant of homosexuals. And but the wonderful thing, though, is that they connect that to paganism, you see. And that's the evil of the Nazis. The evil of the Nazis was that there was a rebirth of paganism, and that's why they're all homos. Well, that's exactly the thesis of my book. And the way my book is an inversion, if you will, no pun intended, of the pink swastika. It's saying, yeah, you know what? You Christians are right. It is paganism. It's essential to paganism. It's what paganism is all about. You can't have one without the other. You're right. And we're going to take the other alternative. We're going to take that choice you're offering to us. And maybe that means we need to reevaluate National Socialism. You know, maybe they weren't such a bad bunch of guys. And maybe, as you know, a traditionalist like Savitri Devi would say, they were actually trying to restore traditional Western civilization. It's no surprise that they have a certain kind of enemy. We know who that was. And maybe their ranks were full of homosexuals for the same reason. And maybe any movement that expels those people and tries to evade any suggestion that our snappy uniforms make us look gay or our marching around makes us look gay, any movement that tries to evade that slur maybe won't be as successful as even the National Socialists were. I mean, they did, after all, form a government, which is more than you can say for any of these people today.
Back to the popular culture, I know you mentioned Mad Men, and what are some of the other, you talk about Occupy Wall Street, you talk about the show The Gilmore Girls, The Untouchables, the movie They Live. Is there anything you'd like to point out about those topics?
Well, the continuing relevance of much of what I say. The Gilmore Girls thing and the Occupy Wall Street thing, those are the same thing. My thesis was to take a look at the Gilmore Girls as exploration, the presentation over 7 seasons of the essential mentality expressed by Occupy Wall Street. And in general, the peculiar liberal predilection for living in small towns, unlike big cities, where you would think the liberals would want to live. But they all eventually wind up in small towns, which have been cleansed, however, of the working class people. So the liberal utopia is a small American town purged of any small town people. The oddity of the Gilmore Girls was that they had immensely rich parents, exiled themselves because they hated their parents, like all liberals. They exiled themselves to a conveniently located small town filled with entirely white, eccentric working class characters that are just figures of fun, little cardboard cutouts or mechanical ducks or something that the clever liberal girl can make fun of for 7 seasons. It seemed to me this was really the most extensive version of this kind of liberal utopia. In the real world, you know, the liberal likes to live in places like Ann Arbor or Madison, Wisconsin. Key, you have to have money, and that keeps out the blacks, of course, but you're not racist, because you don't have to have any laws saying blacks can't live here, it's just they can't afford it. And it also keeps out those horrible rednecks. So it's ideal, you know. So the liberal utopia is someplace like Martha's Vineyard, or the Hamptons, or Fire Island even, or the college towns. So it's just a bunch of you and your identically thinking friends in this charming, charming small town, which doesn't have any small town people in it.
What do you say about the movie They Live?
They Live is more gonzo than traditionalism. I'm just fascinated by the reversal of a number of things in They Live. The movie is famous for having the longest and stupidest fight sequence in any movie. I think it's like 8 minutes or something like that. And it reverses the customary expectation, because in every other Hollywood movie ever made, I think, certainly since the 70s, the black character imparts wisdom to the ignorant white character. And in this movie, it's the white guy, Roddy Piper, who imparts wisdom to his black sidekick. But in order to do so, because he's a Negro and not that smart, he has to literally beat it into him. So he has to beat this guy for 8 minutes until he finally puts on the sunglasses and can see things. The other reversal is the reversal of the idea that the truth will make you free or the truth will make you happy. The sunglasses cause terrible headaches, and the real world is actually horrible and all that. So it has a number of interesting inversions. But what really goes on in that essay is that, like I say, it's more of a gonzo piece, and the premise is that I'm reading a book about They Live by Jonathan Latham. And as I'm reading the book and watching the movie on Netflix at the same time, I get more and more irritated by his rich, white, liberal, Jewish, urban mentality and sneers and so on at the characters and so on, and it became increasingly violent. At the end of the review, I flip out. It's a more of an amusing piece than a thought piece, as you may tell. I want to emphasize the fact that in the book, it starts off with some theoretical pieces, and then it starts looking at things more from a historical point of view. There's a review of Wolf Grimson's excellent work on the Mannerbund and initiation rite, and that keys into the Untouchables, which I have my essay on the Untouchables. It's reading the entire film as a shamanic initiation ceremony, which I think I can claim is a fairly unique perspective on it. There are Bastian Tips for the Not So Fabulous Rite, which is also balanced out a bit by a piece on white music, which is another excellent example of how this works. You know, I mean, from Lee Atwater, you know, playing his blues guitar at the Bush's inauguration onward, you know, the conventional right has bought in entirely into the idea that black people are the only people who make music. In this essay, I take a look at white music and how much better it is. It also takes off from the idea of, you know, many people are looking at what's called alternative folk, or even for that matter, death metal and whatnot, as being appropriate music for the right. In this essay, I argue that New Age music is the true music of the Aryan people, and just needs to be purged of its hippie elements, which again sort of recapitulates the argument I just made about images of homosexuality. So you have the idea that New Age music is either a bunch of hippies, so it belongs to the left. On the other hand, if you want real music, you have to go to some form of rock and roll, i.e. some sort of black-derived music. And so I try to once more swim between those two clashing rocks. You know, as the title of the book indicates, it's a book about competing images and extremes. And what I try to do is to take various elements of culture or politics, distill out of them those two extremes, the homo and the negro, and connect the homo to actual white civilization and culture, and the negro to everything that's destroying it.
James O'Meara, I'd like to thank you for being on.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me on again. It's always a pleasure.
That's all we have for today's show, so take care, and we'll be back with you next time.